Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Dick Dale and Miser Lou released as a single on the 21st of April in 1962 on the Deltone Records label.
The king of surf guitar. Dead. He's dead.
I know.
He died last week. What are we going to do about that?
Well, the king of... we're playing him.
Well, we
today.
Are. Yeah, because we've had a couple of major incidents over the past week or so, and with people passing away. So, and the first one's Dick Dale. And the interesting thing about Dick is that he wasn't called Dick at all, was he? He was called Richard Anthony Mansour.
That's great. Do you know how he got his name, though?
No, go on.
He met a guy. Now, look, hang on, I've got this in my notes. It's really interesting, right? He was influenced by Hank Williams and he began playing in local country bars, and then he met a guy called Texas Tiny who gave him the name Dick Dale because he thought it was a good name for a country singer.
No.
Oh, yeah. That's really funny.
Well, the thing is that he actually invented surf guitar. And, I mean, if you think about it, this is 1962.
Yeah. Right?
So this is really early. So if you're thinking about it, we're talking about the Shadows.
Well, of course, yeah.
You know, with that instrumental thing. And the Shadows had that very British sort of twangy sound. But this, drenched in reverb. And apparently, he was massively loud. And I didn't know this until recently, because when he passed away... I'd always seen him with, Fender Dual Showmans,
right,
and, like, 2x15s with JBL speakers in, which, like,
yeah,
the metal,
yeah,
cones. And it looked very odd setup to me. But then, when you look into it, and you did the notes earlier on, and Leo Fender worked closely with Dick Dale in producing the first 100-watt amp.
He did, because, you know, Dick Dale kept on blowing things up. He was so blinking loud.
Well, but you see, the thing is, it sounds so clean. To get it loud and clean is really difficult. You need really, really big amps, you know? And Leo Fender said, when it can withstand the barrage of punishment from Dick Dale, then it's fit for human consumption.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, so, I mean, developing a 100-watt amp in the early 60s, because when Marshall started, of course, they started with the JTM 45, which is a copy of the Fender Bandmaster, which is, you know, it was like 40 watts. And that's the amp, basically, that I use now live with us. It's like a Marshall clone, a Jimino, very fine one.
Yeah.
And that's only 40 watts of the 4B12. But it's got that sort of early British sound. And because what Marshall did, he actually recreated the Fender Bassman circuit with British components.
Right.
And when he did that, it changed the sound. And I think he tweaked a little bit of it. But it was like principally an exact rip-off, really, of a Fender.
Yeah.
But, you know, Leo Fender, being Leo Fender, who was, I mean, he's produced some of the most iconic, probably the most iconic guitars of all time. You know, the Stratocaster, the Telecaster, the precision bass, the jazz bass.
Yeah.
And all these came within a few years, you know. I mean, it's amazing what he did. And Dick Dale played Fenders, didn't he? But what, did he play them upside down or something?
He was left-handed, and then he tried a right-handed guitar or something. Then he went back to left, but he didn't change the strings, so he played upside down. So he was playing with his hands across the top of the frets as opposed to going up from underneath and doing chords that way.
Well, it is wild. I mean, there are a few other players, and I don't want... I think I know, but I'm not going to get shot down because I don't want the torrent of emails that will come in about me actually making a cock of this. But he really created this whole sound, and I think a lot of that surf generation, was influenced by, you know, by Dick Dale.
Well, what was really interesting, and I didn't know how this all started, but he was playing, and he was playing dances for surfer crowds. And there was this one night when there was overcrowding when he used to play in an ice cream parlour, so he had to look for another venue. And so he approached the owners of the Rendezvous Ballroom in Balboa in about mid to late 1961, and it was like 3,000 people capacity. And they said, yeah, you can put your concerts on, but no alcohol, and had to be a dress code. And it took off. It was sold out all the time. And that's where the surf sort of sound came from, from those gigs that he played. Isn't that crazy?
Well, this song, it's like an Eastern Mediterranean, isn't it? An early known recording was...
1927.
Yeah.
I don't know how you pronounce it, though. It's there was a Greek rebetiko or siftet. Tatelli composition. It was
sounds like you want to eat it with some pita bread, don't you? Really, that
you do actually, and it's all like there's also Arabic belly dancing, Armenian, Persian, Indian, and Turkish versions of the song. It's very popular apparently in the 1920s in the Greek American and the Armenian American communities who settled in the United States. So this is how it all changed, though. Somebody, during a performance, bet Dick Dale that he couldn't play a song on only one string of his guitar. This is how Miserly came along. And his father and his uncles were Lebanese-American musicians, and Dale remembered seeing his uncle playing Miserly on one string on an oud. And so he basically upped the tempo really, really quick to make it sort of more of a rock and roll song, and that's how he did it, because he'd already seen his relatives play it. And that's where that song, that version of the song came from a bet.
Wow. And well, and of course, I mean, he was in relative obscurity until Tarantino used it in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
And that's...
Well, he was. He used to be on TV in America and everything, though. He did have a bit of a rep, really. But I think sort of worldwide, I think his career resurfaced and regenerated with Pulp Fiction.
I mean, the film was... It's one of my favourite films of all time, of course. But it's an amazing... track to play in that film, because what it does, it really sets the whole scene,
you know,
for the film. It gives you an atmosphere, doesn't it? And I mean, Tarantino's brilliant at that, because, you know, Kill Bill, the music he used on that, and Pulp Fiction, I mean, they're just incredible works of art from a sonic point of view as well, because it's so appropriate, the music he chooses.
What I love about that, though, is that came from people, it came from dancers, it came from a crowd, you know. He developed his sound, and I know he's not on the planet anymore, but, you know, get in there, Dick Dale, kick ass.
Naked as sin, an army towel covering my belly, some of us blush, somehow knees turning to jelly. Next, I was still just a kid, there were 100 like me, I followed a naked body followed me. Next, I was still just a kid, when my innocence was lost in a mobile army whorehouse. gift of the army, free of cost. Next, you're next, me. I really would have liked a little touch of tenderness, maybe a word, just a smile, some instant happiness. But no, no, next, next. Oh, it wasn't so tragic. The high heavens didn't fall, but how much at that time I hated being there at all. Next, next. Now I always will recall the brothel truck, the flying flags, the queer lieutenant who slapped our asses as if we were fags. Next, your next. I swear on the wet head of my first case of gonorrhea, it's his ugly voice that I forever hear. The next, next, that voice that stinks of corpses, of whiskey and of mud. It is the voice of nations, that thick voice of blood. Next, next. And since then, each woman I've taken to bed seems to laugh in my arms and a whisper through my head. Next, next. All the naked and the dead should hold each other's hands as they watch me scream at night in a dream no one can understand. Next, next. And when I'm not screaming in a voice grown dry and hollow, I stand on endless naked lines of the following and the followed. Next, next. One day I'll cut my legs off and burn myself alive. Anything, I'll do anything to get out of line just to survive. A never to be next, or never to be next, next.
Scott Walker, and next from his second solo album, Scott 2, released in May 1968, released on the Philips record label in Germany and the UK and Smash Records in the USA. Sadly, he died on Friday, the 22nd of March in London, aged 76, from cancer. What a horrible thing. It floored us because I've been through about four or five, what's the word, rites of passage with Scott Walker, because yeah. I remember listening to him when I was a child. We didn't have much music in the house when I was a child, but I remember listening to him there because it was a sort of palatable thing, you know, all that Walker Brothers stuff.
Yeah.
And then I sort of rediscovered him later on. And then I rediscovered him again a bit later on with Bowie. And then I rediscovered him recently with you.
Yeah.
And we've been playing a lot of the records and we featured them on the show. We featured this track on the show before, which unusually we're playing again because you really like it, don't you?
I do.
So talk to me about Scott Walker.
Well, do you know when I heard the news, I felt very teary. It was just... and the thing is that when you talk about Scott Walker, you know, I don't know. There are moments of him that I really connect with, and other bits I have no idea about, but I just love him. I find his existence and his effort and his creative integrity so inspiring, and yet I didn't always follow him. But I was reading, so I've been reading some interviews about him as well, and this one guy said, in the broadest possible terms, and this kind of helps in a way, his career can be divided into quarters. Mm. And if you think about this as broad brushstrokes, you've got Scott One, and he was a member of the extremely popular 1960s group, the Walker Brothers.
Of course, yeah.
And they were so big that they even eclipsed the success of the Beatles in 1966.
Wow.
Scott Two was a solo crooner who released a quartet of peerless self-titled LPs that painted rich vignettes of life in the late 60s, kitchen sink dramas channeled via the spirit of Jacques Brel.
And that was a Jacques Brel song that
of
we
course.
Just listened to, yeah.
Yes, next, indeed. Yeah. And that was written by Jacques Brel and Mort Schumann.
Hmm.
So Scott Three was a near washed-up figure who dampened down his creativity with marathon whiskey binges while releasing unsatisfying solo country and western and middle-of-the-road albums. And he had this kind of cash-motivated Walker Brothers reunion.
Mm.
And then the Scott Four, that last quarter, was and remains a highly misunderstood left-field artist with no peers. This is what I liked about that, no peers, he's recorded four of the most challenging rock records to be released on relatively large labels as Climate of Hunter, Tilt, The Drift in 2006 and Bish Bosh. So what's interesting for me with Scott Walker, though, is that when he had all that success and he ripped it up because it didn't satisfy him. He was always trying to, he didn't want to keep repeating himself. And he was just, later on I'll talk a little bit more because I've got some comments about what he said about his creative process. Because sometimes when other people write about you, I don't necessarily think they get it right. And it's better to hear it from Scott himself about his creative process. But it was, I mean, incredible.
Well, on Scott too, because Jonathan King wrote the liner notes, and Scott Walker actually said that it's the work of a lazy, self-indulgent man. That was Scott too, and that's fantastic, you know. And then he added, "Now the nonsense must stop, and the serious business must begin." And I know I've heard stories because the funny thing with this is that we've got an interesting connection with Scott Walker, because the guitar player who used to be in a band called The Disciples with me is a guy called Eddie Horrocks, and Eddie Horrocks now runs 4AD Records in London, and Scott was actually on 4AD Records,
yeah.
And and 4AD supported him massively to do some very, very challenging stuff. And the next track, in actual fact, we're gonna play something from Tilt.
Indeed. Well, actually, 4AD, they released a press release when Scott died, saying, "For half a century, the genius of the man born Noel Scott Engel has enriched the lives of thousands. Scott Walker has been a unique and challenging titan, audacious and questioning. He's produced works that dare to explore human vulnerability and the godless darkness encircling it."
He was so strong, he was so bold. When they made him, it broke the mold. If it heads this way when the moon is low, come over and pray. They'll turn the buffalo, they'll turn the buffalo. There's a need to sleep in the shag of his stomach, slide around his eye with your loving toe. If he heads this way, don't you say hello. Get out of the way, they'll turn the buffalo, they'll turn the buffalo. Our town, do love a stampede. Stampede by my old jacket in the park. Someday I'll pick it up, look for the label and whisper, "Tilt ain't got none, no, no. Tilt got none at all. Tilt ain't got none, no, no. None at all." The mother waits, still as a moonlight, standing in long grass with a cold, cold nose. What she feels so deep, she will never show. Baby, don't you weep, they'll turn the buffalo, they'll turn the buffalo. We'll be right back. son to love a stampede. Stampede by my old jacket in the dark. Someday I'll pick it up, look for the label and whisper. Tilt, it got none now. Tilt, got none at all. Tilt, it got none, no, no. None at all. It was so strong. Just think of me when we get
marvellous Scott Walker and Tilt, and that's from his 12th studio album, also called Tilt, and released on the 8th of May 1995 on the Fontana record label. And the album's the first instalment of a trilogy that went on to include The Drift in 2006 and Bish Bosh in 2012, and it reached number 27 on the UK album charts, but he didn't release any singles. And it was his first studio album in 11 years.
Apparently, he locked himself in a cottage in England somewhere and he spent 10 years writing the lyrics. Apparently. That is what I've heard. And I think, and also, I mentioned before how the third time I got introduced to Scott Walker was I saw a performance on Late of Jules Holland.
Right.
And it's actually rated as number 9 of the most important performances ever to be on Jules Holland.
Really?
By NME. That's right, yeah. And it was the first time he'd been live for years, and he'd never appeared live again after that.
No.
And he did Rosary from this very album.
Oh, right, okay.
And I remember seeing it, and I at the end, nobody knew what to do. Because it was so weird, but so intense, and it was almost chilling. And it's available on YouTube, so it's probably worth looking at it. But that was, you know, and that was, and that's what I started to get interested in him again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Incredible. But the sound there, because it sounds like a Chapman stick on the bass. Sadly, at the moment, I mean, we're in Germany at the moment, we haven't got full internet capability, so we're running around trying to download and do our show by going into
various cafes. And, yeah. Yeah, buying a coffee and sitting there for as long as we can keep on the internet to get the...
It's thrown us off after 2 hours, so... but hopefully we'll get that sorted this week. So we're slightly at sixes and sevens with our internet, and we don't have any 3G at home where we are, so it's a bit difficult to do the research. But anyway, so you're getting a lot of real personal experience here.
Yeah.
And... It was recorded at Rack Studios, and I know we've talked about it before, but was it 20th Century?
Oh yeah, that was the DVD, wasn't it? That
yeah.
It was a 2006 documentary, 30th Century Man.
Yeah,
exec produced by David Bowie. And it featured, like, I remember watching it, it's fantastic, and had testimonies from Jarvis Cocker, Damon Albarn and Brian Eno. And what I love about it, Eno says that that Scott Walker took music to a place that it hasn't actually ever been since. And then David Bowie, what did he say now? Something about who knows? Who knows about Scott Walker?
Well, apparently David Bowie was really absolutely over the moon because didn't he get a birthday card off him or something?
Yeah,
or a phone call?
David Bowie, later on. Yeah. I've got that. We'll talk about that later in the show.
Well, because the whole thing about Scott Walker is that he did severely influence so many people.
Yeah.
Certainly. I mean, when you listen to David Bowie's vocal style, it is Scott Walker. He's done a complete, on some of the tracks, he does a complete emulation.
Yeah.
And like, I think later on, I mean, today earlier on, we listened to The Next Day, didn't we? Or was it, no, it was Black Star.
Yes.
That's right, sorry. Yeah, we were listening to Black Star. And it's clear that the way he'd gone really was really trying to, you know, trying to get into the territory, I think, that Scott Walker was in. And I think that last album, controversially, wasn't as good as some of the, you know, the Scott Walker stuff, because it wasn't quite as out there, you know. Mm. I think he was trying to push it out there, but it didn't quite achieve it in my
personal opinion. About that. So what we're going to do about this, so this show today, really, is that it's got a, it's all connected to Scott, and we're going to be playing songs from people who've been influenced by him and who love him. What I really like about, and I think that if you don't understand all his music, what I like is his creative approach to writing. And he says, you know, I can't tell you where it comes from. It comes from silence, most of it. I sit around and I'm waiting. I'm waiting. I'm waiting. You know, and the thing is, when you read interviews with him, and then not that many, he's such a beautiful hearted, yeah, spirited man. He's so unassuming, and he's struggling, and he's been trying. It's like with Tilt, he was getting people to play minor chords and major chords at the same time. He would surprise the musicians. He had to work with musicians who could read music, because he wanted to go into the studio fresh, because he only had like a guitar and an amp and a 5-octave keyboard at home. So he didn't have any particular idea, you know. He was always surprised in the recording studio, because obviously that's when he heard it,
yeah,
for the first time. And he was saying with Tilt, he wanted people to play it fresh, and he didn't want them to be a group, because then it would change the way that the music was created.
Yeah, I get that.
So they hadn't bonded in that way. And he said that he'll start with an idea. The next part might come up in a couple of months. He said, but nothing's wasted at all. He'll read something or see something, and they think, oh yeah, that's where that goes then. And he said he's trying to go for something like as carved down as possible. It's not like a Dylan song or a Neil Young song where everything's moving along. That's not what he wanted. He wanted... he said that was a bit too pat for him. So I'm not quite sure what too pat is. But he says, yeah, so by the time he gets to the studio, he doesn't have drum machines, he doesn't have click tracks, very little overdubbing. He'll take it home, have a listen, and then, you know, he'll go back in and do it again. But he works with his co-producer, Peter Walsh, who basically understands how he works, and he just kind of... He gives them an indication of what sound he wants. And I think they've got this kind of, or they had this...
synergy, yeah.
Yeah, where he didn't feel they had some ego to prove to him. He was just really relaxed with him and very open. And I think that he worked really well with him.
And the interesting thing is, once he'd actually listened to the final mix, yeah, of the record, he never listened to his own work again, ever.
Now, isn't that beautiful?
Sure is.
Standing at the door of the pink flamingo, crying in the rain. It was a kind of so-so love, and I'm gonna make sure it never happens again.
So take off that unbecoming frown. What about me? Well, I'll find someone that's not going cheap in the sales. A nice little housewife who'll give me a steady life and won't keep going off the rails. Take your hands off me. I don't belong to you, you see. Take a look at my face for the last time. I never knew you, you never knew me. Say hello, goodbye. Say hello, wave goodbye. We've been involved for now, and to keep you secret, it has been hell. We're strangers meeting for the first time, okay? Just smile and say hello.
Say Hello, Wave Goodbye by Soft Cell. And that's Mark Orman singing there. Severely influenced, I suspect, by Jacques Brel and Scott Walker, who we're talking about today, due to his sad demise last week.
But I think it was David Bowie. Mark Orman was saying it was hearing David Bowie's version of Brel that really turned him onto Jacques Brel in a big way.
Mm.
And of course, Bowie was influenced by Scott Walker.
Of course.
So it's passing along, isn't it?
Well, you know the funny thing about that song, though? It's one of my, surprisingly enough, many of you out there might not realise, but it's one of my favourite songs of all time. Probably in my top 20, certainly.
Yeah.
You know? And I actually sang this at
One Night Stand
on the Isle of Man, where we had a series of artists and singers, but they weren't allowed to play anything. They had to just sing, and
That's
I had to sing without a guitar, which was very odd for me.
Yeah, it's great.
And you did Blanket, didn't you,
Imogen Heap.
Imogen Heap, that's right,
yeah.
On that night. But it's a great song, but you can hear that, you know, almost theatrical voice that Mark Orman's got there. And you can definitely connect it, you know, with Scott Walker.
But you wouldn't really notice that. I mean, when he heard about Scott passing away, he said he was absolutely shocked by it. He said Scott Walker gave him so much inspiration, and so much he owes to Scott, even down to his early Soft Cell haircut and dark glasses.
Is that right?
Yeah. And he cemented his love for Brel, and he said that Scott Walker was enigmatic, mysterious, and with some of his latter recordings, to him, infuriating, which I can really relate to, you know.
Yeah.
With somebody, you just go, what are you doing now? I want to love you, but you're confusing me. And he just said that he thought he was an absolute musical genius, existential and intellectual, and a star right from the days of the Walker Brothers. And there's so many songs that will go round in his head forever, and that voice. And the bit that got me, actually, you said that we've lost Bowie, and now we've lost Scott, and there is surely a crack in the universe. And I just thought, oh God, you know,
yeah,
because that really got me. Because we've got in the house, haven't we? The stars look different tonight.
We have,
and I have that as just because for me, Bowie. We were talking about it earlier. We still can't believe he's gone as well.
Yeah,
it's weird, but
He's been a real influence to so many people. But I mean, he's touched us in Bowie as a couple, hasn't he? Really?
Yeah.
And Scott, you know, and Radiohead, and you know, lots of other people have actually got that thing going on. You know, that Scott thing.
I know. And what's really interesting is though, and I know, unusually for the show this time, I do want to just quote some direct quotes from people talking about Scott and talking about different artists, because I think this is really important as well. And Mark Horn was saying that he'd been aware of Jacques Brel through hearing Scott Walker and Alex Harvey, but it was David Bowie who really sanctioned Brel as being very cool for him, because Bowie opened up a whole world to when Bowie mentioned a singer or a writer or an artist, he had to go and check them out. And they would become a big part of his cultural sphere. So there was Lou Reed, Lindsay Kemp, Iggy Pop, Jacques Brel. And when he said as well, when David Bowie recorded Pinups, all the artists he covered were instantly cool. And his influence on pop culture, he said, was enormous. And I'm sure it's the same for many musicians of his generation. And he said, Bowie taught me what my teachers at school couldn't.
Sculptures of them, then drags them to the river's bank and the court. Their soggy paper bodies wash ashore in the dark. And the priest defended, now demanding from Miguel of his well dressed up men for the pleasure of that priest. Here I am, not quite dying, my body left to rot in a hollow tree. His branches throwing shadows on the gallows. And the next day, and the next, and another day.
David Bowie. And The Next Day, from his 24th and penultimate album, The Next Day, released on the 8th of March in 2013 on his ISO record label under exclusive license to Columbia Records. It was also his 66th birthday and his first album of new material in 10 years.
Recorded at the Magic Shop with Visconti at the helm, producing.
Yes, in secret.
And the beauty of the Magic Shop is that it had that magnificent old Neve console in there.
I knew you'd say that.
And it's recently closed down that studio.
So sad.
Yeah, because property developers wanted to make it into flats or something, right in the centre of New York. Absolutely tragic. Anyway, that's something else. We're talking about David Bowie here and Scott Walker.
Indeed. So the story starts with David Bowie was having a relationship, or not on-off relationship, with an ex-girlfriend of Scott Walker.
No.
And she kept on playing Scott's music day and night. And so, and of course, that's when, and it was at that time when he was doing the Jacques Brel. So that persuaded David Bowie to go and see the theatre show, Jacques Brel. And of course, and then, so he was basically hooked. Yeah, so that's really where it all started for David Bowie.
Amazing. Well, you know, I mean, it's clear when you listen to anybody, as I said before, that, you know, the influences. But what I love about that song here, and it is completely different than Scott Walker, is that he's actually gone back to very rock and roll sound there, you know. And I've got to say, I mean, Ronno, you know, it was an amazing guitar player, and I think he suited Bowie a lot better. And, you know, because he's had some great guitar players, Reeves Gabriels and all that sort of thing. And here, of course, Jerry Leonard's playing guitar. And I've got to say, I'm not a great fan. It sounds a bit thin. I don't particularly like his guitar sound. I just don't get him as much as some of the magnificent guitar players I've had before, Earl Slake and Carlos Alomar and, you know, all these people over the years. But, you know, it's a great song. But the thing that gives this song the real richness is that blasted video. Because the video is amazing with Gary Oldman. And he's a Roman Catholic priest, isn't he? And he goes in, there's all debauchery. It's a great video and, you know, a real work of art, isn't it, I think?
Oh, it's fantastic. And what I really loved is the detail is that when he starts off with Gary Oldman going in at the front, the sound changes as the door opens and closes. It's really like as if you're going into a venue.
Yeah.
But we chose this one because we think this is such a beautiful example of David Bowie really and his influences. But really, Scott was an idol of his from a child. Because what happened was that in 1997, Radio 1 ran a special 50th birthday show for David Bowie. It was Marianne Hobbs, actually.
Okay.
And they'd got Scott to record a birthday message for David Bowie. And he's basically saying, hey, I'm coming to you via a very crappy old handheld tape machine. And he just wished him a happy birthday. And he just thanked him, you know, for his generosity and have a great day. And David Bowie said, he just sat there and went, that's amazing. I see God in the window. He said he really got to me there, I'm afraid. I think he's probably been my idol since I was a kid. That's really moved me, you know, going to have a copy of that. And I think that was such a beautiful moment for him. And what he was saying about Scott, that he didn't want to abide by the rules of the genre, and he kind of opted out of rock very early on in his career. And it just seemed he wanted to expand in some very unusual ways, and that was pretty much what Bowie wanted to do. And he always admired people like that. And when he was sort of covering this and being influenced by the Brel songs, he was actually saying David Bowie didn't care what the meaning of the song was, because he made his own interpretation of the song. The meaning was not important to him. So that's another interesting point as well. And I thought that was fantastic as well when he actually exec produced 30th Century Man as well.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
the incomparable Radiohead, There There, released as the lead single from their sixth album, Hail to the Thief, on 6th of May 2003. Again, a performance which is unmissable from live Later for Jules Holland. An incredible performance. I remember seeing it. And again, you can hear that influence. And, you know, Tom York said that Scott was a huge influence on Radiohead and myself, showing me how I could use my voice and words, and described him as a kind, gentle outsider. You know, and Tom York, I just love that, because Radiohead, to me, are the most important band that have been around for ages, because I think they really have pushed the frontiers of stuff. I remember when this came out, it was amazing. Kid A was amazing. All the stuff they've been recently, it's amazing, you know. And you know, In Rainbows is probably my favourite album of all time. And Tom York actually said that this was his most important recording at the time. They thought they'd lost it because they did it Ocean Way in Los Angeles, and they weren't happy, so they re-recorded it in their home studio. Well, Radiohead's home studio is a home studio, isn't it? And, you know, it's such an influence that Scott Walker has had on these guys, you know. And Nigel Godrich said, who's the long-time producer, of course, "So sad to hear about Scott Walker, one of the true greats, so unique and a real artist. On my way to work on the first day of recording OK Computer, I passed him riding on his bike in Chiswick High Street. And when I got to the studio, Tom was holding a copy of Scott 4. And there you are. But it's the end of the show.
I know, I can't believe it. It's like it's gone so quick, and but this week's shows has meant so much to us. I mean, every week it has, but I really hope you've enjoyed it. And please do to find out about Scott Walker yourself. You know, try Scott 2, Scott 1.
Yeah.
And just, you know.
Tilt.
And Tilt. Well, actually, Nigel went in on a couple of days on Tilt as well, you know.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So he was really chuffed a bit to actually go and work with him on that. But, yeah, so we're going to play you out with a song by Echo and the Bunnymen and The Killing Moon.
But so but of course, he didn't like him, did he? McCulloch, he didn't like Scott Walker.
He said he first fell in love. The very first song that he fell in love with was the Walker Brothers, "The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore."
Yep.
But he didn't particularly get him when he went solo.
Mm.
But you can hear the influence.
Of course you can.
Exactly.
It just sounds like him.
Yeah. I mean, what was interesting as well is that Richard Hawley was saying, you actually try and work out what Scott is actually doing with his voice. He said it's incredible.
Mm.
The technique that he's got.
Yeah.
And even Scott Walker's saying that he really works on his voice and so that it's not over emotional and not too deadpan. And it really, you know, he really, really works hard on trying to get that balance. And we know what that's like as well,
you
know, when doing vocal takes to try and get it so you're not over dramatic, but at the same time, you don't want it too cold so people can't connect with you.
Correct.
It's quite interesting. But anyway, so please do drop us an email or get in contact with Facebook or Instagram.
We're everywhere. iTunes, Mixcloud, everywhere. So you can just look us up. Sue Starlight, Simon Campbell.
Indeed. And we leave you with a quote today as well that Richard Hawley said about Scott Walker. And this is for all artists and all creatives. He said, "The biggest lesson I've taken from Scott is be brave. Don't be manipulated and always follow your own path. To plough your own furrow is the key. It doesn't matter if no one listens, expletive, because they will eventually."
In the starlit nights I saw you, so cruelly you kissed me. Your lips a magic world, your sky all hung with jewels. The killing moon will come too soon. Fate up against your will, through the thick and thin, he will wait until you give yourself to him. Through the thick and thin.